Is this the view of the incoming Biden administration? Should Americans anticipate more lockdowns?
Well, I don't think this is a lockdown or not locking down. I think that's how we thought about this in this spring. But I think we've learned a lot since then about how this virus spreads and what we can do to reduce risk. And right now, the way we should be thinking about this is more like a series of restrictions that we dial up or down depending on how bad spread is taking place in a specific region. In New York City, for example, what you're seeing is them target their interventions down to the zip code. So we're not in a place where we're saying, shut the whole country down. We got to be more targeted. If we don't do that, what you're going to find is that people will become even more fatigued. Schools won't be open to children, and the economy will be hit harder. So we've got to follow science, but we've got to also be more precise than we were in the spring.
That was Dr. Vivek Murthy, co-chair of President-elect Joe Biden's Coronavirus Task Force, speaking Friday on Good Morning America. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Reason Roundtable. I'm Matt Welch, joined by my coughing colleagues, Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangue Ward. What is up, my kids?
Howdy.
Hey, Matt.
Happy Monday, everybody.
We're going to talk about the bad news about coronavirus, but also the late-breaking great news about the coronavirus in a second. But first, coming soon to a website near you is Reason's annual and very beloved Webathon, in which we provide you, dear listeners and readers, gifting opportunities to help make our work at this podcast, website, magazine, foundation that publishes all very possible. It's going to run from around November 30th to around December 7th, sometimes gets fuzzy. And as part of it, we here at the round table with Joseph Biden are going to be taking your questions, smart, rude, random, whatever. Send us questions. Email them to podcasts, plural, at reason.com. by December 1st, and we will try to answer each and every one of the Safe for Work questions in a special Webathon episode. Again, podcasts, reason.com. You'll be glad you did. Okay. So great news this morning after a long period of not great news. Moderna has announced that it has a COVID-19 vaccine that in early trials shows a whopping 94.5% effectiveness rate, which is really great. This is the second company after Pfizer did it last week to advance in the great vaccine race 2020. Both of those will require two shots. Moderna said it's going to have enough doses to vaccinate 10 million people by the end of this year. Pfizer, 25 million. There are also like 10 other companies entering phase three of tests. This is all just very marvelous. Less marvelous is that the whole country, every last bit of the United States basically right now is rushing towards a corona calamity, or at least really high positive rates. Cases, we're setting new records on a daily basis. Hospitals and ICUs are filling up rapidly. Death rates are still, knock on wood, not quite as high as they were back in the really bad old days, but they're increasing and they tend to lag other factors. Mayors and governors everywhere are basically reinstituting lockdowns, restrictions, recommendations, telling everyone to please try not to travel to visit Thanksgiving or visit your parents during Thanksgiving. Looks like we have to hunker down yet again, wait out for the plague winter until the vaccines become more widely available, all against the backdrop of a totally normal presidential transition. Peter, you heard Biden's coronavirus dude at the top of this podcast. Now that we're no longer in campaign mode, when Joe Biden would just say, we need to have a plan. What can you tell us about the practical differences, to the extent that we know them, and the import of the practical differences between the outbound Trump administration and the inbound Bidenettes?
Joe Biden's plan is different in a couple of ways. I'm going to go through them. But I think as I do, you're going to start to see that there is a thread that connects them, a kind of a theme here. So the first thing, as we know already, is that he is going to has already put together a team of advisors, a task force whose members have already been announced. The task force will actually meet, and Joe Biden will actually listen to them or pretend to. The COVID response group being chaired by Mike Pence right now, the vice president, for example, has not been meeting for most of the fall and has been largely MIA since Trump is so mercurial and it's difficult to make policy with a group like that under someone like Trump. So the second thing that Joe Biden is going to do is he's going to recommend masks, strongly recommend, and use federal levers of power to push for mandates where possible. That might mean a requirement not everywhere in the United States, but for masks on travel that crosses state lines where the federal government has some power. Third thing he's going to do is he's going to focus on addressing the disparate impact of the coronavirus. The virus has been much more deadly for minorities than for white Americans, and that's going to be a priority for the Biden administration. They have stated that several times. Fourth thing is he and his advisors are going to communicate more clearly and more consistently. This is one area where I think the Trump administration really has fallen down on the job, and where a Biden administration, or pretty much any halfway normal non-Trump administration, will probably do better. And finally, his advisors are going to push, as we heard, for mandatory closures in targeted areas. So both geographically, and then they're also going to target certain types of businesses and gatherings. But I think we're going to especially hear a lot about indoor dining, bars and restaurants, where state governments clearly have a lot of authority. I wouldn't be surprised if schools ended up being part of that mix too, simply because that's a place where there are a lot of government pressure points. But I do say push for, because remember, the White House cannot implement these business closures on its own. They have to come from state governments. So if you look at all of these differences, what you see is not an entirely symbolic list, but one that is heavy on symbolism. And the symbolism is designed to say there is a process. The Biden administration is going to go through that process. They're going to take it seriously, and they're going to perform seriousness and competence to make a point of the contrast with an administration that was decidedly unserious and incompetent. And I would say that's true even with Biden's pick of his chief of staff, Ron Klain, also intended to send that same signal. Klain was the White House Ebola response coordinator under Obama, was generally credited as having done a good job, set up contact tracing systems, trained hospitals all over the country when there were only three hospitals that were really set up to deal with Ebola, generally stayed on top of the problem. And I would also say that masks are part of that. So masks are certainly effective at reducing spread, but not fully preventing it. And I definitely think people should wear them. But I also think that masks serve a secondary purpose, which is they provide a visible sign that people around you are taking the virus seriously. And Joe Biden's push for masks is part and parcel with that. So what we're seeing here is, in some ways, just a sort of performance of seriousness, a performance of we are going to do this the right way, the serious way, the competent way. And I think you can criticize the Trump administration for having not taken this nearly seriously enough and not been super competent in the way that they responded. At the same time, Joe Biden's response is, in its own way, just a sort of, it's not quite a facade on top of that, but there are certainly elements of sort of a seriousness facade that has been built on top of what Joe Biden wants to
do. A mask, if you will.
Yes. Catherine, as Peter alluded to, a lot, perhaps the majority of the way that these policies or relevant policies are enacted are on the state and local level. In fact, I'm going to fact check Vivek Murthy. It's not that it's super targeted by zip code in New York City, at least when it comes to schools. They have a blanket. If the city has a testing, community testing rate of 3%, all the schools get closed, regardless of the fact that schools random testing is showing just 0.17% positivity rate. Rant tabled there. Catherine, so you live in D.C., from what I understand. How's the whole cognitive dissonance thing going on when you're having, like, you know, street protests and clashes and violence on one hand, and you can't visit mom for Thanksgiving on the other?
It's not going great, I have to say. I am experiencing a lot of it, and I think everyone in the country should be if they're not. I mean, we had quite a lively national conversation about when you are allowed to ignore the prohibitions on large gatherings in coronavirus times over the summer. And a bunch of people established that they felt that there should be an exception for large-scale outdoor political speech. Now, I actually think that there's a lot of arguments for that. Political speech is the most important speech to defend in many ways, and we should be very, very wary of a public health apparatus telling people they can't do the political speech. However, this weekend in D.C., we had some protests from Trump supporters, and the rapid pivot from your outdoor political speech is constitutionally protected, exception to all of the coronavirus mandates, to how dare, made me dizzy, at least. And I didn't enjoy that. So I think that the question of how come I can't have Thanksgiving, how come I can't have my grandmother's funeral, how come I can't have school, but you can have your rally, is going to become more acute before the problem is solved. I saw in passing a headline today about an underground fight club that was still meeting somewhere in coronavirus times, like a literal, like, Tyler Durden fight club. The first...
Please tell me it was a libertarian.
As far as I know, it's not libertarian inflected, but this, there's going to be more of this. There's going to be more corona speakeasies, and they are going to be alluring and problematic in equal measure. And I think that we set ourselves up for this by making a bunch of exceptions for, well, if your thing is really, really important to my cause that I endorse, maybe it's okay. And then just secondarily, I will say the weird twist where you can eat in a restaurant as long as that restaurant is in a plastic tent outdoors, I don't get. I'm confused by that. Like, there's a bunch of large plastic baggies dotting DuPont Circle in which people can eat. Apparently, it's fine because it's technically outdoors. Again, I actually think there are lots of safe outdoor activities you could probably do unmasked. And I am hesitant to say, let's do a big national mask mandate. In fact, I am not just hesitant. I think a big national mask mandate would be a disaster. It would be a very bad idea. However, wow, people are really interpreting COVID restrictions based on their own priors.
I just want to say, for the record, that speakeasies are a form of political speech.
Thank you, Peter.
So this is, I mean, you're joking a little, but you're not joking at all. And this is going to be a thing going forward. It's like, what if your speakeasy is a gathering to plan the revolution? Then it is political speech.
Nick, there are quite a few people in our broader universe, or the broader libertarian universe, Fat Russell comes to mind, Jeffrey Tucker, who seem pretty ready to man the barricades in the face of new proposed lockdowns. Two questions, or a multi-part question. First, are you, Nick Gillespie, breaking out your Gadsden flag mankini in advance of the new lockdowns in California? But more generally, how are the...
Wait, you don't want me to answer that?
No, I do. It's a okay. Two-part question. I'm like a White House correspondent, right? Okay. I've got to talk for like 5 minutes and confuse
fake
everybody.
Fake news, Matt Welch. Fake news. You're fake news.
Wow. You're busting out the impression 4 years into this? This is great.
You know, I work on my own time, Matt.
How are the restrictions or the concepts, the specter of the new restrictions playing out in a restriction-heavy state like California?
Mm. You know, I have talked to a bunch of people out here who are, you know, kind of casting, you know, central casting liberals, all of whom to a person hate Gavin Newsom. It's kind of like the way that the voters who put Gavin Newsom in office hate him. It's similar to the way that everybody in New York, you know, voted for Bill de Blasio, but everybody hates him. And Newsom's Thanksgiving recommendations are, you know, that was in place before Andrew Cuomo. And these guys are clearly, you know, they are the Biggie Smalls and Tupac Shakur of gangster governors. And, you know, I don't know how that ends. I know how it ended for Biggie and Tupac, and the music world was worse off. But unfortunately, we're going to see these lumbering giants probably clash in the 2024 presidential race for a Democratic Party nomination. The best thing about Gavin Newsom is that you can only have people from three households. You have to eat outdoors. His guidelines discourage singing. So like that whole tradition of Thanksgiving caroling, it's gone. We're not going to be singing any Thanksgiving carols. And people are kind of fed up with it. By the same token, what's happened in California, and I think this also happened somewhat in New York, is that people have kind of built into their lives social distancing, or a lot of people, people who can. And so I think one of the problems here is that there's a complacency setting in, like we can wait this out. And this is, I think, part of the issue with everything we're talking about, the people we know, how we live our lives, like we can kind of wait things out better than, you know, the 60% of Americans whose jobs are actually can't be done from home, can't be done in isolation. And I think that's a real problem. I'm worried, you know, Biden has not even taken office yet, and the press is already still talking about coronavirus in a way that I think they are going to abet a continued and long-lived lockdown independent of better risk assessments. It seems like there is a consensus out there among experts that grammar schools, elementary schools, even probably high schools should be reopened. And we're not going to see that, I think, as a result of this. And I think it's bad news.
Peter, Nick kind of mentions media obsession on coronavirus. But I mean, the graphs look terrible, do they not? I mean, it's almost as if the last couple of weeks of election and all the usual craziness that we can expect from it might have even suppressed a conversation, or at least, you know, muted the conversation about like how bad is it? Or am I succumbing to MSM alarmism, Peter Suderman?
Well, I don't know about your personal issues, Matt Welch, but it's pretty clear that we are in the worst moment in terms of spread in the United States that we have seen so far. Yes, the graphs look bad. That is one way of putting it. If you go back to April, which in some ways felt the worst, you had fewer than 50,000 cases per day. We never exceeded 50,000 cases in April. We started to...
Those are recorded cases. Right. Those are recorded cases.
That's true.
There's the possibility that there was more out there in the universe, and we just didn't kind of know
that. That is definitely true. And then we started to exceed 50,000 cases in that summer spike that came, you know, in July. And then things calmed down again in September. And we are now seeing well in excess of 100,000 cases every single day. I'm looking here at the one of these dashboards on November 13th, just a couple of days ago, we had 181,000 cases. Now, we are better at treating this virus and better at saving people's lives than we were in April. We know a lot more about it. At the same time, it's still deadly, and we are still, and deaths follow case increases. And so we are now on track to increase it to case inc- to death increases in the next few weeks, and deaths have started to pick up, though not to the level that they were in April.
Correct.
Right. Well, I think this is part of the issue going forward. Is, you know, it's conceivable that the death rate was higher early on because the disease was wiping out people who were more likely to succumb from it. Also, a bunch of bad policies put in place by people like Andrew Cuomo and quarantining old people who overwhelmingly, far more than any racial disparity or ethnic disparity or even gender disparity, it's age is the, you know, is the comorbidity here. That's the big thing. But I'm looking at the New York Times, the 14-day change for cases. It's up by a million plus. It's up 93% over the past 14 days. The death rate is -7 over the past 14 days. And this is not necessarily going to stay this way. But, you know, just as there was a mistake made early on in talking about this as a national pandemic, when in fact it was a series of regional, you know, there were regional problems that should have been dealt with on a regional level, it's conceivable that the death rate is not going to spike anywhere near the case rate. And you know, what worries me is that Donald Trump in the final presidential debate said, you know, Joe Biden has no plan to reopen the country. And I think that's a legitimate critique of where Biden is coming from. And I think the media is going to be very complicit in that.
I think that deaths as a percentage of recorded cases are going to be much lower here in the next 6 to 10 weeks, even as we have spikes in cases than they were in April. That said, I do think that we are likely to see increases in deaths here in the next 2 to 4 weeks because there is typically a lag between case increases and death increases. However, the plan to reopen the country, to the extent there is one, is a vaccine. And we have good news on that front, which is that we have two vaccines that are are in final stages of development, and millions of doses are going to be available probably before the end of the year, but certainly by January, unless there's a big hiccup. Now, you're right. We're not all going to be able to get it in December and January. We're not all going to be able to get it in March or April. But tens of millions of people are likely to be able to. And that's the plan that Trump has. It's also the plan that Joe Biden has. And no one has a better plan than that.
I have a better plan.
I think there is a better plan, which is, you know, to allow parts of the country to open up that could open up relatively safely, including things like K through six schools, if not K through 12.
Well, and I think, as you have pointed out, neither Joe Biden nor Donald Trump have the power to make those allowances very much themselves.
Yeah, look, if Joe Biden, one of the reasons why people were, I think anti-reopening is precisely because Donald Trump seemed to, you know, he wanted to open things up. So all right-thinking people are like, well, if Donald Trump is for it, I'm against it. If Joe Biden is symbolically, telling us to wear masks and things like that, he could also symbolically say, you know, what we need to do is to figure out how to protect the weakest among us and then open stuff up otherwise, because this is, you know, it's not as simple. And I'm not saying you think this, Peter, but it's not as simple as saying we just got to sit tight, you know, sit on our in the life raft until the vaccine comes along and then everything will be OK. We need to start segregating, you know, the actual high risks of this and getting on with, I think, opening up the country as much as possible.
This discussion, though, really highlights how we have, to a large extent, made incredible strides, incredible progress in technology and innovation. We have gotten better at treating COVID, and we have two vaccines, you guys, two. It's incredible. At the same time,
yeah, and probably several
the
more
allocation
on the way.
Of those vaccines is a political problem, and our politics is broken, right? Like, this fight that Nick and Peter are having right now is the fight that the whole nation is going to have in a way stupider version, because there is
going to be... The allocation of the vaccines is not simply political.
It will be very political. I think it is, you know, there will be many different paradigms for vaccine allocation that you could imagine, and they will be fought over viciously, and that
I agree with. I agree with that completely, but it's also just the production and the invention of the vaccines itself is not simply political, right. And in that, you know, I think the country has been doing kind of the right thing, you know, which is
distribution.
She
said distribution. I would underline,
I think we need to caution ourselves. Like, so a bunch of drug manufacturers have said they've got really great vaccines that are, you know, in the pipeline and are going to drop immediately. I think a bit of caution about that and about the time that it will take to get the rollout and to do it successfully. Like, it's not going to be the end of January. We can, you know, we're all going to be out and about. It's a really long process that's going to unfold over a year, probably at the very least.
And in the meantime, and Catherine, I wanted to just actually get an anecdote from you about this, about the opening of schools. Obviously of poignant interest to me in New York City, which has one of the most stringent requirements for schools staying open, is that the community positivity rate has to be below 3%. Just today, Mayor Bill de Blasio, who I never voted for, Nick Gillespie, as you well know, I don't blame me, I voted for Joe Loda. He reiterated, in the face of a lot of pressure, including from the New York Times at this point, their education reporter, who I would never have expected to do this, but like has been busting his chops. Like, what is this 3% number? The statewide number in New York is 9% is what the recommendation from the LoveGov about, above that, maybe close the schools, because as the science is pretty clear at this point to suggest that it's not that elementary schools are not being vectors of of spread. It's one of the safest places you can be, actually, is a five-year-old in an elementary school.
Hey, there's a plan. Let's all go hang out in elementary school.
Nope. De Blasio. Like
Billy Madison. Billy Madison is industrial policy.
We finished? De Blasio said, well, I think it's important to stay with a 3% standard because that's what we negotiated, which is great. It's because I said so. And he negotiated that with public sector unions with whom who are incredibly crucial to his rise as a politician. He's in hock to the public sector unions. That's why he delayed the opening of the school year for no scientific reason at all twice. This is what he came up with in a negotiation. I mentioned this as preamble, not just because a lot of different school systems and cities are also like this, but so is the Democratic Party writ large on a national level, including Joe Biden. I would love to see symbolic Joe from the White House say, hey, you know what? 3% sounds low. I'm not in charge of schools, but I'm just saying, you know, come on, man. I don't think that he's going to say that. I think that's a damn shame. And I want to ask Catherine before we stop on the topic, just because I heard in Washington, D.C., at some point they were saying like, yeah, we'll open the schools right after the election, which doesn't seem to be scientifically based. It's just my thing. So what's the status of the District of Columbia's school opening or lack thereof, Catherine Mangu Ward?
We have a slightly lower per capita journalist density here in D.C. than you do in New York. So there's been a little bit less coverage of the absolute omni-shambles, shenanigans, garbage mess that is D.C. school reopening. You know, there was a minute where it looked like for a minute they were going to open like a little bit of school in a kind of unhelpful way. And then they were like, oh, no, JK, we're not even going to do that. But then I think on Wednesday, they still might open an even littler little bit of school based entirely on whatever teachers wanted to volunteer to do school. So it is, in fact, a real case study of the power of teachers unions once again. And, you know, the frustration that DC area parents have had with the changing standards and changing expectations. Certainly, I have struggled with it. And I think this is the flip side of, you know, they say, okay, when we hit a threshold, a certain thing is going to be triggered. When we hit 3%, the schools will close. At least that would be a predictable standard, right? Like the thing that we are lacking in coronavirus generally is the ability to plan. And, you know, I agree with you. I don't think that 3% standard has like a strong scientific basis. But I will say that anyone anywhere who is willing to figure out how to make any kind of pronouncement about schools that is in any way predictive of what might happen, say, 3 weeks from now, I would welcome that at this point.
Wow, that's a serious battered wife syndrome over here. OK.
Yeah.
We're going to dive into last week's cliffhanger about the future of the Republican Party. But first, I've got two words for you, kid. Bitcoin. Retirement. That's right. If you're like me, when someone tries to tell you how to mine cryptocurrency or whatever on the blockchain, dealio thingy, whatever, you do a lot of nodding and you daydream about the starting lineup of the 1905 Philadelphia Athletics. This is why BitTrustIRA.com exists. BitTrustIRA helps people who want to diversify their portfolios into crypto without having to learn entire new secret languages. Go to BitTrustIRA.com/reason to get your fancy fee waiver, $50 value, and learn about their unlimited trading platform, super low fees, and more. That's BitTrustIRA.com/reason. Visit today. You'll be glad you did. Our podcast advertisers are solely responsible for their content and views, which do not necessarily represent the views of Reason. I also would remind listeners that before making any investment, you should seek independent financial, legal, tax, and regulatory advice.
I like your official guy voice.
Always wanted to do that. I'm so happy.
Oh, that was delightful.
Yeah, I'm just going to make up ads so I can do disclaimers at the end.
I fully support that.
If the erection lasts for 17 days.
Nope. Don't support that. Withdraw my support. Support removed.
All right. So last week in minute 50 of the podcast, Nick tried to initiate a conversation about the future of the GOP and how it got into its current state and where it might go. I dictatorially quashed it. So let's get into it. Nick, since you started it, and since you in the same podcast suggested that maybe it's time for the Libertarian Party to hang it up, you also expressed your mild lament that Trump didn't win the election. Maybe you can kick us off by showing us whatever glimmers of usefulness or hope you see in the current party's sort of stance of big government nationalism and where it might go from here.
I don't have a lot of optimism about either of the major parties. And obviously, if I was just saying last week that maybe the LP should hang it up, I think maybe it's time to leave politics and, you know, just get on with tending our own gardens, Matt. We need to be like Candide at the end of that wonderful Comte de Philosophie.
Lenny Kravitz is right.
No. Yeah. You know, I think that the one of the big revelations of this election, and I don't think that we've talked about this quite enough, is, you know, people voted Trump out of office. People who supported Biden were overwhelmingly talking about getting Trump out of office rather than anything positive about Biden. Down ticket, they rebuffed pretty harshly a kind of what they perceived as a left-wing version of the Democratic Party. We do not have a political party that comes close to representing, you know, the thick middle, 60%, 80% of people who, for instance, might want to pay reasonable taxes, be left alone, be able to, you know, get an abortion if they need it. You know, the party that represents that person does not exist. You have to pick and choose between two equally unfavorable or unpalatable exceptions. I don't see the Republican Party coming out of this and embracing a kind of libertarian ethos of limited but effective government. And for that reason, I'm very despondent over what's going to happen, not over the next 2 years, but over the next 4 or 8 years, because I think the Democrats will continue to lose House seats. They won't retake the Senate, but that will be because people are voting against them, and the Republicans will be the recipient of that largesse and charity, but they won't actually be making a move to kind of living the rhetoric that brought them to success, you know, only 5 or 6 years ago, a libertarian rhetoric of reducing the size, scope, and spending of government.
Catherine, do you even see a lot of hope for such a rhetoric to come back? Right after the election, I saw a couple of very online libertarians, Austin Peterson and Julie Borowski, get excited about launching Tea Party 2.0. And my reaction to that, among various other ones, was just like, is that in the air anywhere? Are people getting excited? Do you share their enthusiasm? Do you think that people are going to get re-excited about the same things that the Tea Party was 10 years ago?
I want to be clear that I don't share anyone's enthusiasm about anything at all. Just want to start there. I think that the GOP will, in fact, return to saying some words about fiscal discipline. I think that is very likely. It's actually a useful tool in debates when you don't want the other party to do something. That's all. It's a thing you can say. It's one reason to not do things that you don't want done. That said, I actually have genuinely mixed feelings about what to do when that happens. I've seen a lot of libertarians quite reasonably say, this cannot be forgiven. The last 4 years of just wild spending, the last 20 years, the last 30 years of wild spending, sponsored at least in part by Republicans.
We are getting very close to 40.
40 years is enough. Enough is enough. Like, stop believing them. We cannot reward the hypocrites. And I am very sympathetic to that. On the other hand, walling yourself up in a tower that's just big enough for one libertarian and shouting from the top of it that you alone are pure is not going to affect political change. And that's one reason that I, you know, started out the coronavirus discussion by saying the things that are working, as always, are the things that are the farthest from the center of politics. We've got a vaccine, maybe a couple of vaccines coming. We've gotten better at treating coronavirus. We are, you know, there are bright spots and they are so far from the middle of politics. So I certainly don't want to place a single bit of hope in GOP-sponsored Tea Party 2.0. It's not going to happen. If it happens, it's going to be a worse version than 1.0. And 1.0 wasn't that good. It turned out to not be very good. As Thomas Massie rightly noted, it was actually a bid for just blowing up the whole scene rather than a bid for fiscal discipline for the most part. So yeah, I do not want to be cruel and unforgiving. I would like to stay friends with the people who sometimes say the right words, but I am sympathetic to those who are quite done with that alliance.
One way to think about that, Catherine, of the tower metaphor is
I'm trying to do one per pod now.
That, you know, 50 years ago, 40 years ago, whenever everyone here started becoming blinking awake into politics, there weren't a lot of people saying that it was time to legalize marijuana. There weren't a lot of people talking about criminal justice reform in the way they are. If Joe Biden and, God help us, Kamala Harris want to do the reforms and also want to take credit for them, I will not want to give them necessarily credit, but I want to welcome them into doing the reforms. And it's just like if the Republicans want to reignite the fiscal discipline, I will note that they're hypocritical, sure, but I also want that to happen. I want the size of the government to be limited. In fact, I lament that because of their repeated practices to the contrary, that it's going to remove a lot of the juice of that conversation. That shouldn't affect the way that we all individually talk. Peter, Catherine brought up Thomas Massie, which I think is kind of interesting here just to talk about it in our kind of narrow universe of people who are at least familiar with libertarian ideas. It's interesting to note who stayed and who left among sort of Planet Libertarian and the Republican coalition. Thomas Massie, Justin Amash, like, are pretty much besties in Congress together, always has been. But Massie has always been a bit more of what Timothy Carty once called a libertarian populist, right? He tried to create a movement that didn't exactly exist back then. But the ones who stayed are people like Rand Paul, Thomas Massie, who can sort of speak modified Trumpism opportunistically sometimes about some things. And then the kind of, you know, cold-brained nerd Amash, Jeff Flake types, they have to go to the exit. So maybe this shows that in order to succeed in the modern Republican Party, in the kind of nationalism and in the kind of blusterism that it has turned to, you need to speak or embody what Carney was talking about 6 years ago with libertarian populism. What say you, Peter Sudermann?
A couple of days before the election, Elena Plott, former writer for National Review, who now works for The New York Times, published a piece in The New York Times Magazine about the future of the Republican Party. It's a really smart, interesting piece. Would recommend it to all of you. But it has this amazing extended opening anecdote. It leads with a description of what I can only describe as the most normal-ass Republicans you have ever met. They are just like the most conventional, 50-year-old, we love Reagan, GOPers you can think of, and they're competing for a county commissioner seat in Manatee, Florida. And they have all of these plans for doing things that county commissioners want to do. They want to, like, change the tax rate on this type of transaction and, like, you know, have different rules for exactly where the property is. It's just a bunch of, like, county commissioner type stuff. And absolutely none of it made any impact in the race, which became entirely about support for Trump. And so I'm just going to read you a paragraph that includes a quote from one of the candidates here from this piece. This candidate's display of Trump super fandom was a rational political decision precisely because his politics were not obviously Trump-like. I can sit here all day and say, here's my 5-step plan on workforce housing. And a vast majority of voters aren't going to listen to a word I say, this candidate says. But if I say, I support President Trump, and the other guy doesn't support him as much as I do, well, anybody who's going to the polling place, that's the sentence they need to hear. Trump has come to completely dominate modern Republican Party politics in a way that is just kind of weird. And he just overshadows all of the other stuff, the workforce housing plans, the even tax policy, which is a thing that Republicans actually care a fair amount of bit about. And it's really going to be interesting to see what happens after he leaves the White House, when he no longer has real political power, but might have meaningful political influence on a party. And I think that's going to potentially create some real problems for the party, especially if they pursue the line of argument that Trump is, you know, arguing right now, that actually the election was stolen from him, that he really won it. Because if you want different candidates to win in 2024, those people are going to have to say, no, Joe Biden won this election. It wasn't stolen from Trump. Trump lost, and that's why you should nominate me instead. Because otherwise, they're basically saying this is Trump's party and you've got to stick with Trump. Why would you nominate me?
Nick, building on that point, in Georgia, where we're having two runoff elections, that's going to decide the partisan tilt of the Senate. Both candidates, both Republicans, including sitting Senator Dave Perdue, criticized and I think even called for the resignation of the Republican Secretary of State over unspecified irregularities in the election. Basically, they were channeling the kind of, frankly, conspiratorial bent that the president has taken about the elections.
Not just channeling. According to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, those letters were written perhaps not at the explicit behest of Trump, but explicitly to appease him.
Given that backdrop, what does that tell us, if anything, useful about even a post-Trump or just the contemporary GOP, when there's this sense of, and I'm not even thinking about this in terms of Trump focus. I'm thinking, as I do a lot, about the focus of the people who support him, right? Like, you know, back in the day, it was John McCain who was afraid of the Republican base, which he never really had an understanding of. And whenever he was, you know, faced with a difficulty in an election, would suddenly tack super anti-immigration because he thought that's what the rubes wanted to hear. But are people going to tack into this kind of conspiratorial, wild-eyed land? And if so, what does that tell us about the Republican Party or prospects for it to get, I don't know, better?
I think it augurs very poorly for a return to a kind of limited government rhetoric, because, you know, Trump was not a devotee of limited government. He did certain things that were good in terms of cutting regulations and ushering in a kind of ethos of the government shouldn't be, you know, dictating every term that you have. But he also spent a lot of money. I mean, you've written about this, Peter, Catherine have all talked about this, and that's all true. I think the biggest problem with the Republican Party right now is that it is defining itself almost completely, either in terms of being in Trump's shadow or as the opposite of the Democratic Party. A lot of the Republican Party messaging in this election was not actually about Joe Biden. It was about the left-wing socialists who were about to take over if Joe Biden got elected. The Republican Party would be well served to recognize that the reason why they did well down ballot from Donald Trump is not because of what they were offering, but what people feared. They need to do, Matt, when was the first recent Republican Party autopsy?
That's like
that was done, 20, you know, after
2013, I believe.
Yeah, it was after Obama was reelected, when he really shouldn't have been. You know, when you look at historical indicators, Republicans completely shelved that project. If they want to gain a stable majority, they have to figure out how to tap into, you know, a basically centrist perspective among Americans, which is kind of libertarian, but not libertarian. It's not, you know, I'm not saying that the modal libertarian is a small government libertarian, but people need an alternative. And the Republican Party is not providing an alternative that speaks to them. And that won't, you know, they'll do well in 2022 because they're running against the Democrats, who are equally out of touch. But we're a much, much further than the years suggest from that era in the early 2010s, when Ron Paul and Rand Paul and their vision of a limited government seemed to be ascendant in the Republican Party.
I think the split that's going to become really apparent here, that's already apparent in these and the recent election results is the split between college educated voters and non-college educated voters. And that accounts for at least some of the reason why Republicans appear to have picked up Hispanic vote share. It accounts for just some of their success overall in the House, some of their surprising resilience in the Senate, where it looked like they were going to definitely lose control, or quite likely were quite likely to lose control, and now are probably going to keep it if they can win just one of the runoff elections in Georgia. And that split is really going to define a lot of American politics as Democrats become the party of the educated and Republicans pursue a kind of post-Trump strategy of appealing to non-college voters.
I think also to kind of conjoin that somehow, you know, one of the problems is that at the state level, when you look at states like California and New York, both of which are super Democratic, run by Democratic governors, the people who live in these states are not happy with state government. It's very expensive and it doesn't really deliver the goods very well. And a successful party would tap into that. Because the people in California and New York, the voters who vote Democratic, are college educated, but they're also, you know, they're tired of kind of having to pay for a lot of stuff that doesn't work very well. And to the extent that the Republicans go after or define themselves as the non-college educated party, they're going to have trouble kind of getting those people to roll with them.
Catherine, in talking to people who were friendly with our universe and but overlap perhaps a little bit more with Republicans, they see three basic camps. One is the sort of withered Rand Paul Mike Lee caucus, Thomas Massie, definitely not, you know, driving the bus right now. Another are the new nationalists, which our pal Stephanie Slade has written about, I think most spectacularly. And then also the never quite give it up neocons led by, or they probably call interventionists now, since that phrase has lost a lot of its meaning and people don't really use it anymore. So I guess this is a long-winded way of saying, Catherine, who are you going to pick, Josh Hawley or Tom Cotton?
No, thank you. I mean, like, as a... Point of fact, this is why I don't vote. This is one of the reasons I don't vote, is because I don't want to pick either of them, and I don't have to. And I think that, you know, if we do see some opening or softening to libertarian points of view on the left, I would be delighted to expand my options to Josh Hawley, Tom Cotton, or Kamala Harris. Oh no. That's the worst thing I've ever said.
Wow.
But no, I think the options offered by mainstream politics, at least as they look from, you know, from where we are currently sitting in the next 2 to 4 years, look quite dark for libertarians. And you know, it is not the libertarian moment. It is, I guess what I'm saying is, I have dramatic hope that something will be just totally different 2 or 4 years from now, because as we've seen from the 2016 election, especially, we're not so good at predicting what twists and turns politics are going to take. So I am basically just hoping for something weird to happen. And, you know, maybe that's like me every Tuesday and also me every 4 years. But I do think that there's a chance that, you know, I am not alone, that we are not alone in being very disappointed by the mainstream offerings, and that will drive change. But I don't think it's a sure thing. And if the mainstream political options continue to be as abysmal as they currently look, then I plan to opt out even further from politics. And I think people like us should do that.
I was kind of hoping that We Are Not Alone was going to be a segue into the aliens, which the 2020 Ooh. Writers have been teasing for a while.
That is what we're waiting for, right? That's the last twist in 2020.
Denouement.
Or the murder hornets.
Okay, let's move directly towards our end of podcast cultural recommendations, what we've been consuming. I will make the rare step of going first this time, just to give Nick an opportunity to make fun of me. I watched for the first time in its entirety, although you couldn't help as a kid of the 70s to have this trickle onto your skin through osmosis. That's right, Catherine. The filmic, incredible extravaganza, Jesus Christ Superstar, for the first time. Oh my God, people, this I can't recommend highly enough as a family movie with a 12-year-old. Maybe not the 5-year-old. Yeah, that thing's rated G. At the front, it flashed a rated G. There's like a self-lynching of a black Judas Iscariot. This is like not a G. The undulating prostitutes in the temple.
A self-lynching? You mean a suicide?
Yeah, but it's
born out of the fact that he killed the Messiah.
It's shot very much like a very, very eerie lynching. It's just so marvelously insane. I knew enough from childhood that to expect, the hot pants, the drug hippies, the Jufros, all this kind of stuff. I did not expect a fat King Herod shirtlessly throwing bagels at Jesus. Certainly not. And I didn't know that Jesus was a heavy metal singer. And now I've just been rabbit holing. Apparently the original production had Ian Gillan from Deep Purple. Holy cow. Been listening to the soundtracks. Elizabeth Nolan Brown is right. It is incredible. And the best part about it is like, why the hell did they do that? Why did they make this? What's the point? None of it makes sense. And it's marvelous. And I love it. And that's the memo. Nick, what have you put to me?
Matt, I highly recommend you check out Godspell next because it's set in New York. It's set in a kind of post-apocalyptic New York, the movie.
I didn't realize
it's more of a singer-songwriter kind of vision of Jesus.
Van Ronk?
It is actually.
So it's like a sequel to Fallout.
Wow, Matt. I don't know what to say about Jesus Christ Superstar, but I'm glad, 45 years after it came out, you're finally getting around to it. That's great. By the way, the King Herod character in that is played by Josh Mostel is taken almost verbatim and into Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ. It's the same Herod.
Really?
Yeah, basically. It's really a fascinating kind of osmotic riff on Herod that has carried the day. Well, Matt, can we engage a little bit about Jesus Christ?
Absolutely.
Superstar?
That's why I went to you next.
Do you buy the theology in it that he's a man, he's just a man? Or is he delusional, or is he the son of God?
I think, like all great art, Nick, it's ambiguous whether it is or not. It's like, did he get whipped up by the cult? And boy, that is a cult around him. Holy crap! That's just like the Manson children, all around Jesus. It's unclear. I'm not sure that he knows either.
I do like the faux progressivism of like we're going to give black actor. We're going to give you a major role in Jesus Christ Superstar. We're breaking all kind of barriers here. You get to be Judas is Carrie.
Yeah. Oh, it's
that's kind of Hollywood liberalism at its best.
And just when you think that Carl Anderson, who plays Judas, is tremendous in that, but then the Broadway original musical soundtrack is Ben Vereen, who also is like astonishingly great. But
astonishingly black as well.
Oh sure. Oh sure.
Yeah. One thing that is kind of fascinating about the movie is that Jesus actually kind of holds up. Typically, in Jesus stories, Jesus is always kind of dull and uninteresting. And I think Ted Neely kind of brings it as the son of man.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I want to talk about what I consumed then, Matt, but in fact, what I did consume was Virginia Postrel's new book, The Fabric of Civilization, How Textiles Made the World. It is, she actually goes to ancient history to talk about where fabrics come from. It's an incredible, a characteristic virtuoso performance by her in terms of mixing science, history, politics, economics into a really fascinating, thick, deep history of where thread comes from and then cloth. She's got a great piece in the most recent issue of Reason that's pulled from the book or not pulled from the book, but is related to things going on. But I highly recommend The Fabric of Civilization. And, those dirty hippies in Jesus Christ Superstar would have looked better in polyester, which is one of the surprise heroes of her book.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Speaking of Virginia Pastorell, Catherine, what did
thank
you consume?
Thank you for that segue. I do just want to say about Virginia's book that just as like a testament to the amount of research and work that went into that book. So the book is getting ready to come out. We're talking about, you know, should we adapt part of it for the magazine? And I say, well, you know, you've been writing all of these great columns for us for the last couple of years that are clearly drawn from the book or have gone into the book. So we can't repeat those. And she says, oh, no, that was all just extra stuff. None of that's even in the book. So like there we've been publishing like crazy deep research stuff on like printed calico and, you know, revolutionary garments and how embroidery machines changed native culture. And she's like, oh, no, that was just those were my mere cast offs. Catherine, like, don't even worry about it.
And if I may, just to extend the conversation about her a little bit, she's going to be on the podcast this Wednesday, the interview podcast that I do. But she has a great riff both in the book and then in the podcast about calico, which was a cotton prints from India. And in 17th and 18th century France, she talks about how they were treated the way that the U.S. treats cocaine. And for 73 years, they had increasingly dire penalties for people who smuggled in calico, calico fabric from India. And, you know, and it's just fat, you know, it's so rich with this kind of history. And she points out that a lot of early classical liberal writings or certain early classical liberal writings were actually done to say, you know what, it is wrong to kill people for smuggling in cloth. You know, so it's, you know, it's just a rich book from all sorts of perspectives.
Awesome.
So, of course, the thing that I really consumed and really want to talk about, but I will limit myself since I've already done it so many times, is the SpaceX launch. You guys, it was so good. They did so well. I was so proud of them. It was a successful launch. It was cool. I watched it with my kids, as always, like just such a testament, not only to humanity at large, but to private enterprise saving the government from its own incompetence. Once again, you're welcome. But for something that other people can actually usefully consume, I will recommend Trial 4, which is a Netflix series. It's 8 episodes, and it is the latest in the, you know, Making a Murderer type series. It's a justice denied story about Sean Ellis, who was imprisoned for over 20 years for the killing of a Boston police officer, which Trial 4 makes the quite compelling case that he didn't do. And there's some, you know, there's all the things you would expect from a series like this one. You know, there's race, there's broader sociopolitical relevance, there's a sad mom, there's a sad significant other, there's a really quite, I would say the best character in the series, frankly, is his lawyer, who is just this like very colorful, compelling, crusading lady lawyer character. But it's a little bit too long. It's a little bit too long. It's 8 hours. I probably could have done with like maybe 3 or 4 hours on this story. But if you, you know, if you dig this genre, this is a very, very solid entry in the genre. And it is waiting for you on your Netflix right now.
Editor thinks story is too long.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Suderman, take us home.
I've been watching The Queen's Gambit, also on Netflix. It's a miniseries about chess, life, feminism, mid-century American culture and design. It's richly textured. It's really well acted. And it's also really well directed. There's just a real cinematic verve to it. It feels astonishingly sophisticated and self-assured, even in the golden age of television, for a small screen product. Anya Taylor-Joy's performance as a chess prodigy, she's a sort of autistic but curious, not quite tortured genius moving through a difficult life. It has a real magnetism to it, a kind of studied depth and distance. There's this real sense that you feel like you know her, but also that you don't. Writer-director Scott Frank, who started out writing episodes of The Wonder Years in the 1980s, and also wrote movies like Out of Sight, Get Shorty, and the screenplay for Logan, the kind of old man Wolverine film that came out a couple of years ago. He just has a real sense of how to make his characters both iconic and also how to imbue them with a real pain and a sense of humanity, even if they are somewhat removed from the human normal. It's 7 hours, not eight, and it is the right length.
Thank you. So was the description was the right length. That is all of the time we have for the Reason Roundtable. This time around, check out all of our stuff. The Reason interview with Nick Gillespie on Wednesdays, the Soho Forum podcast on Fridays tends to be. Again, a reminder for the webathon coming up, send us your questions. They can be individual drink recipes for Nick, drug recipes for Catherine. Just mix it up, is what I'm saying. But send them to podcasts@reason.com. That's
send
it.
Send us a cocktail of questions.
Nope.
God. Oy, God. Yeah. Jeez.
I think the sweet, wrong guy was crucified in Jesus Christ Superstar.
Judas was right, Peter.
Yeah.
Judas. Okay. Goodbye. See you next week.
Judas Priest was right.
My husband has been watching Queen's Gambit, and I've been ducking in to try and guess what year each scene is set based exclusively on the dresses. And I got to tell you, I'm doing a great job, just in case you were wondering.